Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm a Senior Research Fellow at the Institute. I'm today joined by Chris Lefebvre, Senior Research Associate at the OIS, to discuss his recent paper, A Review of Demand Prospects for LNG as a Marine Transport Fuel. Chris, great to have you here. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, David. Nice to be with you.
Excellent. Well, look, why don't we start? You know, your paper builds on your 2014 OAS published paper on the prospects for gas in the transportation sector, which particularly focused on Europe. Why have you decided to publish another paper on the same subject at this time?
Well, the last paper identified marine fuel as an area where perhaps natural gas is likely to make some significant headway.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, that's proven to be the case. We've seen quite a lot of interest in that. A number of companies and organizations have made steps to invest in using LNG as a marine fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was important to really see how significant these movements were and how realistic some of the more exciting prospects might be in terms of future levels of demand.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, look, why don't we start by going back to basics, if I may? You know, what are the advantages of LNG over other transportation fuels?
Well, I guess the most significant advantage is, particularly with regard to fuel oil, is the environmental credentials of natural gas. When we compare it with fuel oil, it produces much lower emissions of carbon dioxide and virtually no nitrogen oxides, particulate matters, or sulfur oxides. And these are all very important features.
Yeah.
In addition, LNG does have some financial attractions, though these very much depend on the alternatives under consideration.
But okay, well, I'll come to that in a minute. But before I do that, I just want to ask, you know, the question about, but aren't liquid fuels a much more efficient way of transporting energy for transport than gas?
Well, I think clearly if the gas isn't liquefied, then there's no contest. I think mm-hmm. it's only when we look at LNG that actually gas has a case to be made, particularly in bulk transportation. Compressed natural gas may have a role in land transport, but when we're looking at marine, it's only going to be LNG. And Whilst clearly liquid fuels have got a more established track record, I think as the sector develops and as the efficiency of marine engines that burn LNG improves, then I think they may have a good case to make.
Interesting. Well, just you mentioned the economics, you know. I think just right up front, I'd like to say, you know, is there really an economic case for LNG in transport, or will it need a legislative push to actually encourage the implementation?
I think it's very difficult to imagine many organisations opting for LNG without some other drivers.
Yeah.
There are some economic arguments to be made, but frankly, it does need that legislative push that you've mentioned.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know we're going to talk about marine in this podcast, but certainly for road transport, that's the case, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, let's centre this podcast on LNG as a marine fuel. You know, perhaps you can set out for us the legislative measures that have been put in place to encourage its use.
Yes, and I think it's important to stress that these legislative measures are very much focused on the sulphur content in marine fuel. So they're not really directed at issues to do with carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, there's a global limit of sulfur content in fuel oil of 3.5%. Though in what are called the emission control areas, and there's really two of these, one in North America, one in Europe around Baltic and the North Sea. In these areas, there are already restrictions on fuel oil that mean that the sulfur content cannot exceed 0.1%.
Oh, wow, okay.
A big difference from 3.5%.
Yeah, that's quite a difference, isn't it?
Furthermore, with effect from 2020, the global limit is going to drop from 3.5% to 0.5%.
Right.
And when you think that in 2016, the average sulfur content in fuel oils was around 2.6%,
mm-hmm.
you can see that's going to mean a big shift. The industry.
That's going to be a huge shift, isn't it? You mentioned there are two ECA areas. Do you think we'll see more globally?
It's an interesting question because I think certainly some areas, for example, around Hong Kong and other Chinese major Chinese estuaries, perhaps the Mediterranean, I think there's quite a lot of interest in doing that. So whether those get overtaken by this 0.5% move remains to be seen. But I think there's certainly, I can imagine that perhaps around particular ports where there are large areas of population, we could well see the ECA approach being used.
That's interesting. Well, look, in your paper, you say that the level of usage of LNG as a marine fuel is certain to grow, driven by both environmental restrictions and economic attractiveness. Now, is there really an economic push?
Yeah, I think if you look at the historic figures for LNG prices compared to certainly marine gas oil, then you can see that there's actually quite a significant discount in favour of LNG. So there is an attraction there. Of course, that has to be weighed against perhaps the capital cost of a new vessel or the cost of converting. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is not the only option that ship operators are faced if they want to meet these new restrictions.
Well, what are the other options? You know, your paper refers to scrubbers. Are there any others?
Yeah, so I guess basically the main options are fitting scrubbers, in other words, to take the sulfur out of the fuel oil.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are perhaps a few question marks about this approach, particularly with regard to the disposal of the wash water, which, of course, will be heavily contaminated.
Right.
And I think some have argued that actually it makes a lot more sense to take the sulfur out at the refinery.
Mm-hmm.
And then that perhaps gives us the other options, which is really looking at either a very low sulfur fuel oil or perhaps some sort of intermediate marine gas oil that perhaps has some of the characteristics of diesel but does not, but also perhaps has a more attractive financial case than at present.
Interesting. Well, look, let's talk about the type of vessels and vessel operators, because your paper sets out clear conditions that will be required to maximise the adoption of LNG as a marine fuel. Perhaps you can explain these further.
Yes, and this is really based on looking at where the developments have been most obvious. And, of course, one particular area is where there are these existing emission control areas in North America and Baltic and the North Sea. So that could be one condition.
Yeah.
But there's other factors as well. I think that the large vessels with high fuel requirements and where fuel costs represent a high proportion of total costs, where vessels have regular and predictable journey patterns, because this means it's easier to develop a sort of plan for LNG refueling, because they're not likely to be as many options for refueling as there would be with fuel oil and so on. There's some other factors as well, though. And I think in particular, where operators are also owners of their vessels.
Right.
And that means that if they're going to make the investments, then they will actually recoup the benefits of those investments. I think sectors where there's a relatively high level of vessel turnover,
right,
so you've got a lot of new build or refit, so the option, you're perhaps looking at building new vessels fairly frequently, so you'd look at LNG under those circumstances.
Yeah.
And some other perhaps most obvious things, one I've seen is that sectors where there's a relatively high level of auxiliary power demand,
right,
or perhaps where a vessel spends a long time docked rather than at sea, that's a particular characteristic of cruise ships, of course.
Yes, of course.
And
yes,
what we're seeing is quite a few ports now are introducing rules on shorter ship power to reduce noise and environmental pollution, and LNG could play quite an interesting role as an alternative to shore-based electricity. Another thing I've seen is that I think sectors where you've got a number of very big companies with extensive worldwide operations, again, cruise lines, perhaps container shipping lines, who are prepared to make a sort of strategic commitment to a new fuel.
Yes.
But finally, and perhaps this is an area that I didn't emphasise enough in the paper, but has been from recent announcements, is very important, where we've seen high levels of government support for new investments favouring vessels using LNG. And this, I think, is particularly important in those countries with the shipbuilding industry. Because I think, and I'm not, you know, I don't think this has been properly confirmed, but the suspicion is that this is quite a good way of getting round accusations of state subsidy. But if you're saying, well, we're promoting our shipbuilding sector to, if you like, green the fleet, they can get away with subsidising a sector that might be difficult otherwise.
Yeah, and that, I must admit, that's a very good point you stressed there. But you mentioned specific sectors, and you know, when you talk about regular shipping, that has to link back to the container industry, and also, of course, the cruise lines, and of course, Carnival's recent announcements of their new ships is prominent in the press. But are these the two main sectors, do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, those are the ones perhaps the most obvious. I think I've also seen ferries, particularly in the emission control areas. Those are going to be pretty obvious sectors. And perhaps some of the bulk shipping lines, for example, we've seen some of the South Korean ore carriers, which are doing regular trips between Southeast Asia and Australia. Those could be quite good prospects as well.
Interesting. Well, you in your summary a couple of minutes ago, you did mention the ship owners waiting for new vessels to be constructed. You know, do you think that's going to be a key factor for the implementation of LNG as a fuel? You know, or are retrofits of older ships a realistic economic alternative?
There have been some retrofits, but the figures I've seen suggest that these are costing around $6 million minimum, and so I think by and large retrofitting is unlikely to be practical unless, again, there is some sort of you know, pretty tasty subsidy to make that worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't rule that out. And I'd also point out that actually some organizations have suggested the level of retrofitting could be much higher. So it's my sense is it's not going to be great, but I could well be wrong.
Because it's interesting, you know, that does bring us back, of course, to the estimates that we see in the markets for demand of LNG. And I'm just wondering, you know, as all the things you've listed are very unlikely to happen, do you think the market's being over-optimistic on the pace of LNG bunker demand growth?
I think possibly they are. I think there's been a tendency to pick a number and project that line into the future. And when we look at what's actually happening, that doesn't seem to be reflected in activity at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But as I still believe the sector will grow, perhaps not at the rate of some of the more optimistic suggestions.
Well, I'll come back to that later in this podcast. But the other side, of course, for energy supply is infrastructure. And so I'm just wondering, you know, there's a huge debate in the industry on this, you know, but is there sufficient delivery infrastructure in place? And I mean their bunker vessels and supply ports, you know, and is this actually a key factor that's holding up the use of LNG in shipping?
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting area, as you say, and often referred to as the chicken and egg problem, whereby
yes,
market growth was constrained by lack of LNG refueling infrastructure. And this low growth was in turn inhibiting investments in that infrastructure. I think I would say that I don't think this is such a big issue now.
Mm.
My sense is that infrastructure provision will be relatively rapid.
Right.
And that by and large, it's going to exceed the build-up in demand. And I think this is for a number of reasons. First of all, you know, a decision to switch to LNG is got a pretty long lead time. So.
Right.
I think one is able to sort of put the infrastructure in place. And I think as well that anyone who's committing to a fleet of LNG-fueled ships are going to want to be sure that that infrastructure is there. So they're going to say to their suppliers,
mm-hmm,
by and large, you know, the large LNG shippers,
right,
well, we want you to put in place a contract that gives us both assurances on pricing, but also on physical delivery,
right,
so we can be sure that when we need it, the gas is going to be there.
Yeah, interesting, because we've seen announcements, of course, from companies like Shell and also Total of global supply agreements, haven't we, for that exact reason?
Yeah, no, indeed. I think also, you know, quite a few ports are investing on almost a speculative basis because they can see that, you know, this is a sector they need to be able to demonstrate they're able to serve.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Just going back to the growth again, you know, what other blockers, you know, are there, do you think, for marine LNG demand growth?
Well, you've already touched on those options in terms of sulfur scrubbers or alternative oil. So for a start, it's not the only game in town. Mm-hmm. I think also what we've seen, the shipping market has really been in the doldrums in recent years. There's a big overhang of capacity.
Right.
So that means that, you know, basically there isn't the amount of new builds going on. Mm-hmm. And so it's without that, you know, there isn't the option, if you like, to go for a new LNG fueled vessel. And I think a lot of ship operators are taking a wait and see approach.
Right.
I think the other thing I would emphasise is that you know, whilst LNG does deliver some very significant environmental improvements, it is not a zero carbon solution.
Yes.
And you know, unless you know, we're using biogas in the supply chain, which is perhaps, well, we can talk about that later if you wish. Mm. But I guess you know the fact that you know, we're still talking about a fossil fuel, and the IMO have made these quite significant commitments to reduce the carbon content in the marine sector by 2050. Mm-hmm. Those organisations looking long-term are saying, well, you know, LNG might be a stopgap, but it's not going to deliver a long-term solution.
It's very interesting because that's, I think it is worth discussing it a bit further, Chris, because in your paper you were quite clear that gas is not a zero carbon solution, and giving the continued pressure on the marine sector to improve its environmental footprint, ship owners may be tempted to wait for newer lower carbon options such as batteries and biofuels to emerge. So I think the question really is you know, are biogas or biofuels in a realistic alternative? You know, it seems like you are waiting for nirvana, aren't you, really?
Yeah, I think so. And I think but I think the distinction between biogas and biofuels is a very important one, because it strikes me that, okay, you may well see liquid biofuels playing a role, but it strikes me as that, you know, the possibility of taking biogas and then liquefying it for the marine sector is one that is pretty remote. And actually, if you have that biogas, you're more likely to put it into power sector or wherever, I don't know, but you know, I would imagine marine being pretty long way down the queue. So I think from a gas perspective, I don't think the bio option is possibly not a very realistic one.
It's interesting, I think, because I think you're doing work also on road transport, aren't you, and LNG and road transport.
Indeed.
And their biofuels is actually beginning to want to take some inroads because it's a relatively smaller volume, isn't it?
That's right. And I think there's also evidence that there's much higher levels of state support available in some countries. I mean, Italy's a good example.
Yeah.
But I think even there, it's interesting. I think the costs are high, and people are asking this question, you know, okay, we've got biogas, we can see it's a good option, but do we want to put it into transport, or do we want to put it elsewhere? You know, are there better ways of decarbonising transport?
Well, it'd be fascinating. Well, you know, please do come back for another podcast and tell us about that in the future. I know our audience would like to hear about that. But let's talk really as we kind of get to the end of this podcast, you know, and ask the question, you know, how big is the pie? You know, what type of LNG demand estimate do you believe LNG could reach as a marine fuel?
Well, if you look at the most of the studies that are around at the moment, I think the consensus is that there would be a level of demand of between 20 and 30 million tonnes per annum of LNG by 2030. Mm-hmm. And that's quite an increase on today's levels. I mean, I think that possibly is still on the high side. And if I was pressed to make a best guess, I would say demand level of around 15 million tonnes per annum by 2030 would be more realistic. Mm. But, you know, that's whilst in the sort of within the terms of the global LNG market, that may not be huge. It's still a very significant amount of fuel.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it will, and of course, I think that 15 million tonnes is likely to be particularly sectors, it will play a meaningful role.
Yeah, but it's not going to be the huge demand level that some analysts are predicting, which I think is a really interesting outcome.
Yeah, I think that. And I mean, apart from anything else, to reach those levels, they would have to have a phenomenal acceleration in the level of LNG fuel ships being built. And there's absolutely no sign of that happening. Yeah.
Well, look, let's just finish up by kind of saying, very interesting discussion over the last 20 minutes or so, when we've discussed a lot of issues. But your paper says, to quote, LNG is an answer to some of the problems facing the marine transport, but it's too early to say if it is the answer. Where do you think this is all going to end up? Will we see LNG as a marine fuel being a major cumulative buyer, do you think?
Well, I think LNG is certainly going to feature in the marine fuel markets, and I think that's going to have quite a few disruptive effects, and it'll be interesting to see how those play out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to play a role, maybe not as great as some would hope, but it will still be significant.
It'll be interesting to see, how other fuels actually respond, because of course a lot of heavy bunkers are going into bunkers at the moment. Heavy fuel, going into bunkers. So I'm just wondering about other low sulfur fuels such as gas oil or even low sulfur fuel oil. Do you think that's a meaningful alternative?
Oh yeah, definitely. And in a way, this is the big unknown because we still really don't know how refineries are going to reconfigure, how supply chains might be reshaped by this change in requirements in the marine sector, and they're certainly not going to sit by and just see their market disappear. So I think we'll see quite a strong response, and in a way that's part of the reason for suggesting levels of demand may not be as great that some are suggesting.
Yeah, and can I say, I think that's a very realistic observation, Chris, and I think there is going to be some reaction to it. Well, thank you very much for your time. I must admit, as always when I do these podcasts, I've really enjoyed the conversation. It clearly tells us what's happening in the market for LNG as a marine fuel, and it clearly builds upon your June 2018 paper, A Review of Demand Prospects for LNG as a Marine Fuel Oil. Now, this can be found at the website www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can also find all the OIS podcasts in the multimedia folder and other papers published by the Institute. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you all, and goodbye to everyone.